The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Lara Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor. This week, we'll be talking about how forgiveness was forgotten, asking if the secular tide is turning, and we'll be looking for romance at the British Museum.
So, Will, we're actually talking a little earlier than we normally would because the magazine went to press yesterday, I suppose because of
Good Friday.
Yep. And the bank holiday. And our cover line is, well, it's the Easter special. We've got Douglas Murray writing in defence of forgiveness. Let's talk a little bit about the cover. So we've got a dove.
We've got a beautiful dove drawn by Morton Morland, flying over the cross with an olive branch in its mouth. And Douglas has written an extremely good piece about the lack of forgiveness in the modern world, particularly in the online nature of the whole thing. You know, the online modern world is very, very unforgiving. And he points out in his piece that there is no greater mechanism for society than forgiveness, because otherwise, you know, there's no undo button on human action. So if we lose the value of forgiveness, then, you know, we truly are lost as a society.
It's actually just reminding me, Will, that when I first started here at The Spectator, one of Fraser's first pieces of advice to me when sort of approaching the magazine was, don't ask for permission, beg for forgiveness. So here we are speaking to Alan Dershowitz, one of America's most respected legal scholars and the author of Cancel Culture, The Latest Attack on Free Speech and Due Process, to get his thoughts on forgiveness.
Alan, Douglas Murray writes the cover piece in this week's Easter special of The Spectator. He writes it all about the power of forgiveness and the lack of forgiveness in modern culture. And he connects this idea to the idea of cancel culture and argues that rather than being forgiving and moving on, people nowadays don't want to. Would you say that's fair?
No, I think it's wrong. I think he's focusing on the wrong problem. I think forgiveness is overstated. Forgiveness often sends a message to potential wrongdoers. Go ahead, do the wrong thing, and you will be forgiven. We are a forgiving culture. I've never supported that. I think people have to be held accountable for what they're doing, and they have to understand that although forgiveness may be part of the response, if you do something terrible, no, you won't be forgiven. The problem with cancel culture is it focuses on the wrong people. I'll give you an example from my own experience. I was falsely accused of having sex with an underage person. I didn't seek forgiveness. I sought to prove that I didn't do it. I never met her. I didn't know her. I had nothing to do with her. I went to court. I fought back, and I got her ultimately to admit that she may have misidentified me and confused me with someone else. That's the proper response. The proper response is to fight back, not to get on your knees and beg for forgiveness. And I think forgiveness, for example, in the South African experience, the forgiveness culture backfired and turned South Africa into an absolutely failed country. I think our response to Nazi Germany was much better. We didn't forgive the Nazis. We destroyed them. And then we rebuilt them on our terms. And I think forgiveness is way, way overstated. If you're religious, ask God for forgiveness. But here on earth, in the secular society, I think holding people accountable for what they've done wrong is far better in terms of deterring a repetition of the wrongdoing.
Alan, do you think there's sometimes a grey area, though? Because what Douglas says in his piece is that in the era of social media, things can build and build and build and kind of get blown out of proportion. And at that point, someone feels like there's no way back when actually perhaps what the initial story was not even, you know, wasn't actually such a big deal. Do you think social media amplifies things in a way that allows us to not be very forgiving?
I do, but I think the answer is not to seek forgiveness, because seeking forgiveness essentially concedes that the accusation is correct and that the accuser has done the right thing. He then has the power over you. You have to get on your hands and knees and seek forgiveness. It all depends. If you've done it, if you're guilty, then forgiveness may be a proper demand or request. It's never really a demand because you're not entitled to forgiveness. But I think the first course of action, if it's overstated, is to fight the overstatement, to get justice. Justice is much more important than forgiveness. Maybe that's because I'm an Old Testament Jew, not a New Testament Christian. And the Old Testament is less forgiving than the New Testament. You know, Jesus obviously believed strongly in forgiveness. I think Moses and Abraham believed much more in justice. The Bible says justice, justice must you pursue. The first of those justices means a kind of relationship between the wrong you've done and the consequences. Maybe the second justice can be interpreted as a degree of mercy or a degree of forgiveness, but the first form of justice has to go first.
You say there is a form of accountability from your perspective, but when it comes to cancel culture, is what's happening there that the idea of accountability is being replaced with a sort of gleeful way people rake over outrage? So people may act as if they're holding other people to account online and so on, but what they're actually doing is reveling in a sort of nastiness.
I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. I think in our culture today, we thrive on trying to bring people down, whether they're guilty or not guilty. But I think forgiveness is too soft a response. I think you have to fight against this culture, fight against the gleefulness. There are things such as right and wrong. There is moral clarity, and forgiveness obscures moral clarity. And I think in this day and age, we need more moral clarity and less ambiguity. Forgiveness is an invitation to ambiguity.
And Adam, what would you say to the idea that if someone's asking for forgiveness for something they perhaps said in the past that they now regret or that doesn't seem such a sensible thing to have said? And so they're not necessarily denying that they said it, but they're just saying, please, can you forgive me for this, for what I said at that point? What would you say to that? Should they be forgiven?
Depends on what it is. They should be forgiven for slight misdemeanors and perhaps not forgiven for major felonies. I use felony and misdemeanor in the broadest sense of serious moral failings. No, the Nazis should never be forgiven. The people from Hamas who perpetrated the massacre of October 7th should never be forgiven. They have to be held to account. But people who make a slip of the tongue and who are held to have violated some rule against microaggression, okay, but that's not my style. My style is to fight back and put the onus on the person who accused you and get myself in a position where maybe they ask for forgiveness rather than me. But I'm not a big fan of forgiveness as a general principle of morality.
What do you make of the argument that Douglas articulates in his column that there's no way to undo actions? So forgiveness is a useful mechanism for society to continue. Otherwise, we just end up in cycles that cannot end.
Well, that's okay. Some cycles shouldn't end. Some acts shouldn't be forgiven. I think it all depends on context. I think we live in a culture where there's A, too much accusation, too much glee, and too much dependence on forgiveness. Oh, if you did something wrong, don't worry, we'll forgive you. No, there are unforgivable actions. And I think that line has to be maintained.
Finally, Alan, moving outside of the idea of wider society and public life, do you think that your position is also true in personal relationships, be that romantic relationships or friendships? Where do you see the role of forgiveness there? Is there a role in those private spheres?
Of course, that's very different. Personal relationships are governed by personal preferences. As George Bernard Shaw once said, do not do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Your tastes may be different. So I don't believe that there's one rule for everybody. Personal relationships, there are the kinds of sins that should be forgiven, and there are sins that should not be forgiven, and that should be up to the individual. When it comes to more organized society, government, institutions, universities, the case for applying the rules fairly equally and fairly rigidly is pretty overwhelming when it comes to strangers and governmental and institutional responses to wrongdoing. I think forgiveness is more personal than it should be institutional. Let me add one point. Nothing sickens me more than to see victims of the Holocaust giving forgiveness to perpetrators of the Holocaust. I've seen those scenes, and those scenes are not something that I think should be the rule. They perhaps can be the exception. Every individual can say that, but none of us has standing to forgive actions like the Holocaust. And so when you have the children of Holocaust victims forgiving the perpetrators, it's just not moral, in my view. It's not moral. I think morality has to trump over psychological considerations like forgiveness. Does that mean there will be a perpetual cycle? The old statement, if you are seeking revenge, you know, dig two graves. There is a room. There is room for revenge. There is room for justice. And there is a little bit of room, but much less room for forgiveness.
Alan, thank you very much for joining us today. Lara, what other pieces did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
There's a brilliant piece by Candida Cruel on why the French put up with UHT milk. And I'm sure lots of readers and listeners will sort of recognise that moment when you get to France or indeed actually Italy and are presented with a cup of tea or coffee and it just doesn't taste quite right. And it's because there does seem to be this taste for UHT milk that we really don't have here in the UK. And she looks a little bit as to why that is. So I very much enjoyed that piece. We also have a piece by Svitlana Mornets on the push to revive Ukraine's birth rate. She's writing about soldiers who, before they go to the front line, end up freezing their sperm, which is quite grim, really. If you'd like to hear more from Svitlana, she'll be on Spectator TV talking about this subject. How about you, Will? What did you enjoy?
Well, I thought there was a very good piece by the actress Sophie Winkleman, who is also a crusader to get smartphones banned for children in schools, which is a topic that we've spoken about before in this podcast and are very supportive of. And we're going to listen to an extract of Sophie reading her notebook now.
My life is now hopping on the district line to Westminster for a daily fight to ban smartphones and social media for under 16s, along with a gang of cross-party MPs, writers, teachers and doctors. The facts are so bleak. The failing eyesight, the wrecked concentration spans, antisocial behaviour, insomnia, depression, self-harm, anorexia, porn and gaming addictions and worse. The teens I've met across the country in my role as patron of an education charity are desperate for the damn things to be taken away. Many libertarians think the onus should be on parents to ban smartphones, not the government. That's fair enough in principle, impossible in practice. Every atom of a teen's life is online. Travel card, bank card, social life, even homework. These machines are designed by geniuses to be more addictive than heroin. It's not possible to put them down. Sure, middle-class parents can beg their teens to put their phone away each night. But what about our poorer children whose parents can't always supervise them? They're the ones whose life chances are being destroyed by the compulsive, pointless, damaging junk on smartphones, and they must be protected.
The next topic we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail is Justin Brierley's piece on the rebirth of religion. He argues that after a period of decline, the secular tide is turning and people are returning to Christianity. Justin joined us to talk more about his piece along with Tom Holland, the co-host of the Rest is History podcast and author of Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. I started by asking Justin why he thinks that the tide is turning in this way.
Well, in many ways, it could be encompassed by the subtitle of the book, which is Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. So I've been hosting conversations on faith for pretty much all of my adult broadcasting career. And it really started in the heyday of the new atheism, these very bombastic figures like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, being very vitriolically anti-religious. But what I noticed over the course of hosting these conversations was that the tone was changing. More and more people were saying, well, I'm not really a Richard Dawkins kind of atheist, and sort of starting to push back against what had become quite a kind of quasi-religious form of atheism in itself, in a way. And over time, I just noticed that, yeah, lots more people were rejecting this particular form of atheism. And a whole set of new interesting thinkers were emerging, especially by sort of the mid-2010s, early 2020s, who were not necessarily Christian, But they were these secular intellectuals who were a lot more open to the value of faith. They weren't dismissing it out of hand as the new atheists did. They were saying, maybe there's something valuable here. Perhaps we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater and so on. And so I just noticed a real change in the conversation. And I was also noticing a number of surprising people converting to Christianity. And so all of this led me to think there might be something worth cataloguing here. And that's what I'm calling the surprising rebirth of belief in God.
Tom, you are mentioned throughout Justin's piece. And Justin says that you rediscovered your faith whilst researching your book, Dominion. And he says, to quote, that you are a secular liberal Westerner who lost any vestige of faith by your teenage years, but came to realise you were still essentially Christian in terms of your beliefs about human rights, equality and freedom. So could you start by taking listeners through that journey and sort of that moment of realisation?
Well, you say that I have returned to my Christian faith, which I grew up with. I mean, I haven't entirely. I still inhabit a kind of shadowy zone where sometimes I can completely believe it and other times it all seems complete nonsense to me. And I'm aware that from the point of view of believing Christians, that wouldn't count as belief at all. But I guess the process for me has been recognizing how culturally Christian I am. So I grew up thinking that my values and ethics and assumptions essentially derive from the classical world, and that Christianity had sat like a great roadblock between antiquity and the Enlightenment. And that is essentially the myth, I think, that lots of secular liberals would hold to. But that sense that I was, in all the fundamentals, Christian was very much sharpened for me by the experience of writing about first the classical world and then actually about Islam, which Islam has lots in common with Christianity, but it also is very different from it. And that really sharpened for me a sense that I think the whole of the West is so saturated in Christian assumptions that often we don't even realize it. It's the revolutions that succeed that we tend to forget because we just absorb everything that they have achieved.
Mm. Justin, I wondered if I could ask your opinion on Tom's position as just articulated, because if we're talking about something which is, in his words, essentially an idea of cultural Christianity or Christian assumptions, is this shadowy zone, perhaps, as to use Tom's words again, is that really enough from a Christian perspective? Or is that, you say in your piece that could be seen in some ways as cosplaying.
Yes. I actually borrowed that term from Tom himself. We were involved in a public conversation on these issues not long ago. And Tom talked about this idea of public intellectuals who are kind of attracted to Christianity, but not willing to kind of jump fully in, are kind of cosplaying. They're kind of riffing off the values and the virtues and the kind of the benefits maybe that they feel Christianity has given the West, but sort of, it's a kind of useful fiction in a way. It's kind of playing along with something that they know isn't really true. And I, to some extent, I'm like, well, look, I'm glad that people are kind of recognizing, and I think there are particular reasons right now why they're recognizing that actually there have been great benefits to the Christian revolution. Tom obviously has, you know, written and spoken about at length the way in which many of the things we just take for granted, you know, equality, dignity, human rights, freedom, really do stem from this Christian revolution. And I meet many people like Douglas Murray, who now describes himself often as a Christian atheist, someone who doesn't believe, but essentially knows that all of their values come from the Christian revolution. But yeah, I do want to push them further, because as I argue in the article, the reason I believe Christianity actually made a difference, you know, shaped our moral imagination in this way, is because people really believed it was true, that there really was the possibility of redemption in this life and hope in the everlasting. And that was actually what drove them to make a difference. I mean, C.S. Lewis has this great line about the people who made the most difference in this world are the people who thought most about the next. And I think that's simply true, that actually you have to actually have actual belief for this stuff to actually kind of settle and make a difference in the world. That would be my point of view.
And Tom, how do you navigate that tension between faith and reason in your understanding of Christianity? Do you find yourself moving more to a position where you're perhaps open to believing in certain things that perhaps don't seem totally rational to you?
Oh, completely. I mean, if I am going to become a believer, I'm not interested in reason. I mean, Luther famously said that reason was a whore. If I'm going to become a believer, I want to go flat in. I want devil. I want hell. I want angels. I want burning bushes. I want the full works. I mean, I don't see any point otherwise in doing it. And I think one of the problems that the churches face at the moment, and I would include the Catholic Church, the Church of England, the non-denominational churches, is that they essentially underplay the supernatural dimension, I think, in an attempt to try and appeal to self-proclaimed rationalists. But actually, that's ludicrous. I mean, the whole foundations of Christianity are utterly bizarre and strange and weird. And if that's not being emphasized, then what's the point of it?
Justin, just finally, I would say your piece is rather an optimistic one. But what would you say to thinkers such as a new theist herself, Louise Perry, who in, I thought, a very good piece recently called We Are Repaganizing, argues that actually society is falling further away from some of these Christian values. And actually, in attempts to sort of pick out the bits of Christianity they like and ignore the bits they don't, that's actually failed. And we are seeing, actually, through this sort of increasing secularization, we're seeing a return to pagan values more than we are any return to Christian ones.
I would say mine is an optimistic thesis. I suppose that's partly because I am a Christian at the end of the day. And I believe in a sense that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. Now, it may well get worse before it gets better, but I believe there is a good, beautiful and true story that people will ultimately discover is at the base of all those other stories that are potentially out there. Now, the pagan route is absolutely a direction we could go. I share a lot in common with Louise Perry about fears for that, because I think people have to believe a story. Yeah, there is a rise in that kind of neo-pagan kind of view as the Christian story starts to fade from view. But I think it's interesting because even Louise Perry herself is a great example of this, someone who grew up as a sort of typical liberal feminist who really had some of her own ideas about relationships and sexuality challenged in the process of actually working in a rape crisis center and writing a book called The Case Against the Sexual Revolution, and who now I think is happy to admit that she is very much exploring Christianity as an intellectual and sort of spiritual option. So I'm interested to see these journeys happening. And yes, they may go off in different tangents, but ultimately I think people tend to reorient themselves towards the story that ultimately makes sense. And I think that is going to be Christianity in the end.
Well, Justin and Tom, thank you both so much for joining us. Thank you.
Will, is there anything else that you spotted in the magazine?
Well, Rory Sutherland, who is our Wikiman columnist, has an extremely funny column this week. And there's just one line in it I want to pick out, which made me laugh. He has a really good idea for an interview series where he wants to talk to people who have achieved great things about trivial and tangential topics. And he has a great line in it where he says he's made a start on this already because The Spectator has 30 minutes of unreleased footage of me quizzing the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek about toilet design, which we do actually. So he's right. So
we should release the tapes.
We should release the Slavoj Žižek toilet tapes.
Perhaps our producer Oscar can arrange for that to be sorted. Yeah.
And how about you, Laura? Anything else you want to mention?
Yes, well, there's a brilliant piece by Harry Mount in the front of the book this week. We spotted that the British Museum's new Legion show was apparently, or has rather, become a new pickup spot for women hoping to find eligible classicists. So we sent Harry Mount along to see if that was true. And Harry Mount and Daisy Dunn joined us to discuss this. Harry, in this week's issue, you write about the British Museum's marketing campaign and why there's been a bit of a fuss about it. Could you start by explaining to listeners what exactly happened?
Yes, so it was a slightly dud campaign the British Museum came up with for their new brilliant show, Legion, Life in the Roman Army, about Roman legionaries. And they put out a social media post saying, "Girlies, if you're single and looking for a man, this is your sign to go to the British Museum's new exhibition and walk around looking confused. You're welcome, X. Come for the Romans, stay for some romance." And I'm sure it was down on the back of that viral TikTok trend a few months ago about women asking their husbands, fathers, sons how often they thought about the Roman Empire, which actually, like this, was a bit of a stunt used as a promotion for the Great Mary Beard's book. So they're both stunts. This one didn't work. the previous one for Mary Beer's book did work.
But as you say in The Spectator this week, in the spirit of Socratic curiosity, you went off to the British Museum to see if there was any truth to what they said. What did you
exactly
discover?
So I set off in search of single women, single men in a purely reporting capacity. And there
we don't make your life easy here, do we?
No, exactly. It's a terrible, terrible commission. Anyway, there were single women there, but they were all staring intently, sometimes at men, but one of the men they were staring at was the bronze head of a young soldier who was 2,000 years old, found in Cumbria. I did find one man who had a very keen interest in pegging. That is the pegs at Vindolanda camp, the extraordinarily interesting camp by Hadrian's Wall. So actually, I didn't see a single person looking for love. They're all looking for fantastic objects related to the Roman Empire.
Daisy, what did you make of the museum's decision in this rather unusual campaign? Do you think it was a bit clumsy on their behalf?
I think it was. I think it assumed that we're all familiar with the realm of TikTok and social media and sort of jokes about thinking about the Roman Empire 24 hours a day. And it was clearly intended as a joke. I'd probably guess it was written by a young woman, but it just came across as terribly sexist without that context. God forbid we should just want to go to a museum to look at some art. I mean, that's the sort of response to it. And I think it's easy to be quite sort of po-faced about it all, but I just think it struck the wrong tone. Mm.
And have you seen the show? What did you make of it? Do you agree with Harry that it's a marvellous show?
It's an amazing show. Yeah, I went on the opening night. It's got so much in it that you'd never see before. Sort of shields. I mean, in a way, it's a shame. I'd love to have struck up a conversation with a stranger about hobnail boots. It's kind of sad that...
Be careful what you wish for, Daisy, if you turn up there.
And actually, not necessarily this show specifically, but do you find when you go to museums and galleries, do you find yourself ever talking to strangers? Not necessarily for any romantic intention, but just striking up conversation about the what it is you're seeing?
No, and I think this is the great pity, and I think this is what this post really... It actually struck at this phenomenon that's totally alien now to modern culture, to go up to a stranger and talk to them in public. It's just not done. Everyone just relies on dating apps because it's easier and less confrontational to swipe through to someone than to actually approach someone in real life. So if there's one thing you can say in defense of that post, is that it does actually encourage you to go and talk to people in an exhibition, which I think is actually quite a nice idea.
Derry, do you think that classicists tend to view love perhaps differently, seeing it as they do through a kind of lens of ancient philosophy and literature?
Well, I think if they've read the Roman love poets, they have a deep, deep classical understanding of it. Daisy wrote a brilliant book about Catullus, who wrote some of the greatest love poetry of all time. But also, we must remember that the Romans, we often think of them as being very high-flown, but they were wonderfully direct. If you look at the graffiti in Pompeii that survives, there's one bit of graffiti that says, "Sum tua duibus assis," which means "I'm yours for two asses," which is about two glasses of wine. So it's thought this was at a brothel in Pompeii, but actually they're much more open about sex then, as well as those lovely high-flown romantic lines of poetry that Daisy's written so well about.
Daisy, do you think we're perhaps more uptight than the Romans were?
We're definitely more uptight than the Romans, yeah. I think, I think female classicists in particular are reminded of Ovid. He wrote this sort of whole guide, this is called The Art of Love, and he actually encouraged people to go and pick up women at the races and told them exactly how to do it. And I was reminded, I think, reading Harry's piece, I thought Harry's just like a modern-day Ovid. He's walking around looking for the hidden corners.
Well, that's very kind. As you all know, that Ovid was exiled to the Black Sea for his for that poetry, that love poetry. And so I wouldn't mind being exiled to the Black Sea. Extremely nice, perhaps not quite at the moment in political history, but that's where he ended up and was very miserable.
Harry, our editor, Fraser Nelson, often says that there are a few Latin lines that everyone must know. I want to get your opinion on which lines that you think are utterly essential to drop into everyday dialogue.
Well, there are those which everyone does know, like Carpe Diem from Horace Seize the Day, or Et tu, Brute, supposedly Caesar's last words. Although if you want to be a real clever show-off, you will know that actually the Roman emperors spoke in Greek, because that was the posh language. So his last words were in fact, Kai Su Technon, even you, my child. So that's a wonderful way of showing off when people bring up Et tu, Brute. But all those quotes are quite well known. It's lovely to know the context. So the famous line of "Who will guard the guards?" By Juvenal. We think of that as being a high-minded expression for, you know, who will guard Parliament, who will look after the police, etc. Fact, it comes from Juvenal worrying about his wife having an affair with one of her guards. So he says, "Who will guard her from the guards?" So it's lovely knowing the quotes, but then it's also lovely knowing their context.
And Daisy, just finally, I mean, the British Museum may have got it slightly wrong in the way they approached it, but do you think that classicists do tend to be drawn to other classicists, perhaps because of a shared love of ancient history?
I think to an extent they do. I think we're so aware we're studying something quite esoteric, and it's quite sexy actually to get together with someone and talk about Latin and read some of this incredible Latin poetry to each other. I think that idea is quite appealing. So I think sort of the sentiment was probably right. I think, you know, it would be quite promising. You're much more likely to sort of meet the love of your life looking at some Roman shields than you are in a supermarket, you know, for the frozen peas. And they had sort of single nights in supermarkets not so long ago. So I kind of think the sentiment was there. And for classicists, it could have been something promising, but it just went down the wrong way.
Daisy and Harry, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Well, Laura, you and I joked earlier in this podcast about releasing the Slavoj Žižek tapes, but our podcast producer, Oscar, has actually managed to dig them out. So this joke is now going to become a reality and we're going to hear a little extract. So here is Slavoj Žižek and Rory Sutherland talking about toilet design.
We'll start off then with a bit of toilet theory, because I am the owner, which is very rare in Western Europe. I own a Japanese toilet. And to me, it's unthinkable that you'd ever revert to an ordinary dry wipe, having experienced the vast superiority of the Japanese toilet, which, by the way, was invented in Switzerland, not in Japan.
I've seen Japanese toilets, really, for me, a Japanese toilet worthy of its name at least has to have at least some 25 buttons, you know, with some instructions that you cannot understand. My ultimate fear is that what if with all those buttons, the toilet goes crazy? I'm afraid of this. The second thing, my very nasty dream, once I was in Japan on such a toilet and I did test a little bit all the things it can do, wash it, dry it. And I gave to the guy at the reception there a very dirty association. I told him, "Are you sure this is all the machine?"
I'm completely opposite. I think it's disgusting that the Western Hemisphere and most of Western Europe still dry wipes. Because if you think about it, if you went out into the garden and you potted a plant and you got mud on your hands, you would not think, "Let's rub them very vigorously with some dry paper." You'd use water. So why, when it comes to your rectum, is the West so deficient? The whole of the Islamic world has a bum gun in the toilet. So the whole of the Islamic world can be let off the hook on this one, okay, including Indonesia. The Japanese can undoubtedly be let off the hook. And the Swiss, for inventing through Jebery a disabled shower toilet, which was originally intended for the disabled, but they suddenly realized was actually hugely applicable to everybody. I think the Swiss are let off the hook here as well. But everybody else, the Germans especially, for their weird platform system.
That's a nightmare for me.
Now, my theory is that it makes the smell so unpleasant that you get back to work rather than reading a magazine. And the Germans see, you know, a long, languid defecation as inefficient.
Don't you know, I spoke with this, with serious people, okay, people who knew this in Germany. It's part of a long ritual. It's part of an old-fashioned German ritual that in the morning you defecate and then you smell and observe your excrements. This is kind of a morning medical inspection, you know. It's a whole ritualistic procedure. You can get precise instructions about how to interpret the form of shit, the smell, while I'm here a French revolutionary, in the sense that I just wanted to disappear as soon as possible. You know, again, what's my problem. What's my problem here? My obsession is the one that I read in a biography of Alfred Hitchcock, that when I leave the toilet, there should be absolutely no trace that I was there.
Can you believe, Lara, that we didn't release all 30 minutes of that footage?
I think we should, Will. So that's everything this week. Well, I suppose we just must wish all of our listeners a very happy Easter. And we hope that you join us again next week.
Happy Easter, everyone.